headed for the door. Pancho started to get out of her chair, but thought better of it and sat down again. "Okay, then," she said as Amanda left the conference room. "We got nothing in the way of making an agreement we can all live with." Humphreys nodded, but he was thinking there's nothing in our way except Fuchs. But he's not going to interfere with my plans anymore. He's not going to live much longer.
"Will you release my crew once we reach Ceres?" Fuchs asked dully, mechanically. Harbin replied, "That's not up to me. That decision will be made by Martin Humphreys, I know," said Fuchs. Harbin studied the man. They were sitting at the small table in Shanidar's galley, the only space in the ship where two people could converse in privacy. The hatch to the bridge was shut by Harbin's orders. Fuchs had looked utterly weary, dispirited, when he had first been brought aboard Shanidar. The look of defeat. Harbin had seen it before. A man stops fighting when he becomes convinced that no hope is left. Victory begins when the enemy's will to resist crumbles. But now, after a decent meal and a few hours to adjust his thinking to his new situation, Fuchs seemed to be regaining some spark of resistance. He was a powerfully built man, Harbin saw, despite his smallish stature. Like a badger, or, what was that American creature? A wolverine, he remembered. Small, but deadly. Sharp teeth, and utter fearlessness. For a few moments, Harbin contemplated what would happen if Fuchs tried to attack him. He had no doubt that he could handle the man, despite Fuchs's apparent strength and potential ferocity.
"It would simplify everything if I had to kill him in self-defense," Harbin thought. "Perhaps I can goad him into attacking me. His wife is apparently a sore point with him."
But then Harbin thought,
"To be convincing, I'd need at least one witness. That would be self-defeating. With another person in the room, Fuchs probably would be smart enough to keep his hands to himself. If I tried to goad him, the witness would witness that, too."
Fuchs broke into his thoughts with, "Where is my crew? What have you done with them?"
"They've been placed aboard my other ships," Harbin said. "No more than two to a ship. It's safer that way. They won't be tempted to try anything foolish. I expect them to be treated properly."
Harbin bobbed his head once.
"As long as they behave themselves, they will be fine. And I want them released when we get to Ceres."
Barely suppressing a smile at Fuchs's growing impudence, Harbin said,
"As I told you, that decision will be made by a higher authority. I take full responsibility for everything that's happened."
"Naturally." Fuchs lapsed into silence for a few moments. Then he said,
"I suppose I'll have to speak to Humphreys directly, sooner or later."
Harbin answered,
"I doubt that he'll want to speak to you."
"About my crew, Mr. Fuchs," Harbin said, getting to his feet.
"The fate of your crew is something that neither you nor I has the power to decide."
Fuchs rose also, barely reaching Harbin's shoulder.
"I think it would be best," Harbin said, "if you remained in your privacy cubicle for the rest of the flight. We'll be at Ceres in less than 36 hours. I'll have your meals brought to you."
Fuchs said nothing, but let Harbin lead him down the passageway to the cubicle they had assigned him. There was no lock on the sliding door, which was so flimsy that a lock would have been useless anyway. Fuchs realized that Harbin had been clever to break up his crew and parcel them out among the other ships in his fleet. "I'm alone here," he thought as Harbin gestured him into the cubicle. The door slid closed. Fuchs sat heavily on the hard, springless cot. "Like Samson, captured and blinded by the Philistines," he told himself. "Eyeless in Gaza. At least, I wasn't sold out by Amanda. She'd never be a Delilah, never betray me, never." He desperately wanted to believe that.
"The essence of our agreement, then," said Stavanger, "is that both Astro and Humphreys Space Systems disband their mercenary forces and allow the independent prospectors to operate without harassment." "And without placing any controls on the prices for ores," Humphreys added, with a satisfied nod. "No price controls," Pancho agreed. Dieterling said, "Pardon my bluntness, but don't you feel that your refusal to accept price controls is blatantly selfish?" Not at all, snapped Humphreys. Works the other way around, Willie, Pancho said, quite seriously. Supply and demand works in favor of the buyer, not the seller. But you buy the ores from the prospectors and sell the refined metals to you, Humphreys pointed out. Frowning slightly, Dieterling muttered, I'm not an economist. I think a free market works in Selene's favor, Stavanger said, and Earth's. Pancho hunched forward in her chair. See, if you leave the market open, then the more ores the prospectors locate, the lower the price will go, supply and demand. But Earth needs vast amounts of those raw materials, Dieterling said. Stavanger put a hand on the diplomat's sleeve gently. Dr. Dieterling, I don't think you have any idea of how enormous the resources in the asteroid belt are. There are trillions of tons of high-grade ores out there. Hundreds of trillions of tons. We've only begun to scratch the surface so far. Price controls would work in favor of the prospectors, not the ultimate consumers on Earth, Humphreys said firmly. Or Selene, added Stavanger. Still worrying that uncontrolled prices for asteroidal ores would somehow work against Earth's best interests, Dieterling reluctantly agreed to drop the issue and allow Astro and HSS to draft an agreement. The International Astronautical Authority would be empowered to adjudicate claims against one corporation or the other. There's one remaining problem, Stavanger pointed out, just as everyone was getting ready to call the conference a success. Humphreys, halfway out of his chair, grumbled, What now? Enforcement. Stavanger said. There's nothing in the draft agreement about enforcing the peace. Sitting down again, Humphreys asked, You don't trust us to live up to the terms we agree to? Pancho grinned. I know you can trust Astro. Sure we can, Stavanger replied, grinning back at her. But I'd prefer to see something on paper. George spoke up. We'll enforce the peace, he said. Everyone turned to him. You, Humphreys scoffed. The rock rats? We've got a government now, or the beginnings of one, George said. We'll police Ceres. Any complaints from the prospectors, we'll handle them. Well, how could you? Everything goes through Ceres, George explained. That's where the ships get fitted out and supplied. We hold the water taps, mate, and the food cupboards and fuel tanks, and even the bleeding oxygen for breathing. We'll keep law and order for you. It's in our own best interests.
Dieterling turned back to Stavanger.
Could that work?
We can make it work, said Chris Cardenas, sitting across the table from George.
Stavanger had a strange expression on his face. This means that the rock rats will have political control of the belt. Which is the way it should be, Cardenas said firmly. We're the people who live there. We ought to be able to control our own destiny. Looking from her to Stavanger and back again, Dieterling said,
That is a great deal of power. The entire asteroid belt...
We can handle it, George said, totally serious. Like Chris here said, it's the way things ought to be.
The conference ended, at last. As the delegates got up from the table and made their way to the door, Humphreys remained seated, hands clasped on the tabletop, deep in thought. Ain't you going home? Pancho asked as she came around the table. In a while, Humphreys said, not right this moment. Stavanger was going through the doorway with Dieterling and his two nephews. Big George and Dr. Cardenas were already gone. George had been the first out the door, like a schoolboy racing away from the classroom once the bell is rung. I don't think Mandy will be coming back here, Pancho said. Humphreys made himself smile up at her. We'll see. Suit yourself, Pancho said. Humphreys watched her saunter out the door, leaving him alone in the conference room. So we'll have peace in the belt, he said to himself, and the rock rats will enforce it. Sure they will. He got to his feet and went to the slim little podium that had been wheeled into the corner of the room. The audio-visual controls on its surface were simple enough. With a touch of his finger, Humphreys lit up the wall screen at the other end of the conference room. It showed Selene's logo, the androgynous outline of a human being against the full moon. Scrolling idly through the computer's stored images, he stopped when a map of the belt came up. The wild tangle of orbits looked like a long exposure view of a mad raceway. So we won't bother the Independents anymore, Humphreys said to himself.